Hello!
Hello!
Welcome to the third episode of Season to Taste, our Doctor Who podcast, where we're working through each of the 35 years of Doctor Who, and for each season, having a taste of one story. So far, we have done A Good Man Goes to War from the 34th active year of Doctor Who, and for our second, the randomizer chose us season 23.
And thanks, randomizer.
We opted for what just happened to be the shortest of the four segments of The Trial of a Time Lord, The Ultimate Foe. So before we think about what the next season is going to be, Matt, what did you think about parts 13 and 14 of The Trial of a Time Lord?
It was something of a curate's egg, Will, I think.
And I know you mean that in the traditional sense, that while having good and bad parts, the sum of it was therefore bad.
Yes, absolutely. It basically isn't very good, is it? I mean, there's lots of things to like about it, but basically it's not very good.
I kind of enjoyed it, but more despite itself, and was slightly cringing at much of it. Even part of the point of, as we've said, tasting individual stories is to get the experience of the season as a whole, and the one thing that's definitely it shares with the rest of the season, apart from the fact it's the trial, is a title sequence and the theme tune, which are both pretty horrible.
They are kind of that awful mid-80s garishness and tunelessness and over-synthesised nonsense.
Bibbly-bobbly noises and twinklings.
It's like the Delaware theme of the 80s, isn't it, really?
So, as we had to say in the last episode, we are doing this as a celebration. So before we think about those episodes anymore, what did you like about them?
So, as I said, there's lots of things that I do like. What I particularly liked about episode 13 is it's almost a kind of synthesis of all of the things that Robert Holmes has previously talked about in his earlier stories. So there's that hatred of bureaucracy with the Doctor's encounter with the Popplewicks. There's the a disparaging view of the Time Lords. There's the return of the Matrix, which obviously Robert Holmes invented in The Deadly Assassin and had the Doctor go into in that episode for the first time. So there's lots of things that start to resonate with Robert Holmes' long career with Doctor Who. And it's quite interesting that he really focuses very much on the mysterious planet and wrapping up in episode 13, the Ravalox plot, so the big secret or the big unanswered mystery from the mysterious planet.
Which he wrote,
yeah, thanks Will. Was the secrets of the sleepers, the tampering with the Matrix, the why Ravalox appeared to be exactly the same as Earth. Mm. And it's really interesting that episode 13, he practically wraps all of that up and then introduces a new surprise out of left field, which is the identity of the Valyard. Which, I have to say, the idea is something that I really, really like, because it has that kind of mythic weight to it. The Doctor contemplating his own future and finding it wanting, I think, is a really, really powerful idea. And I really like the concept. I just think it's a little bit of a shame that they don't run with it.
And it ties in, doesn't it, with the idea of the series on trial. And, you know, is the series going to end? Where's the Doctor going? It gives it a bit of weight, and also the chance for Michael Jayston to ham it up hilariously.
It does, yeah.
All the way through.
To be fair, he has to when he's sharing screen with Colin Baker, possibly. And we love you, Colin, you know we love you, but you are the hammiest of all Doctors. So therefore, you know, if you're going to play another Doctor who's a one-off Doctor opposite Colin Baker, you have to really go for the ham, don't you?
And there's nothing understated about that courtroom, is there? It's very much going to bring out those performances.
So I say I love the idea. I think Robert Holmes' original conception was that the Valyard was meant to be the last Doctor. And I've read somewhere, and I can't remember, I've been racking my brains, but I can't remember where I read it, but I believe in episode 14 there's going to be a scene where you see the Valyard as a very old, lonely, broken man, and really his motivation is he wants to get his time back. He wants to be able to do more with his life, and actually he looks back and he thinks, I could have done so much more. And that's quite a powerful idea, and I agree with you, Will, as well. It fits with the whole theme of the season, which is for the first time possibly since it started, Doctor Who's contemplating its own end. So metatextually, I think there's quite an interesting idea with the Valyard, if that doesn't sound too pretentious.
My thing I particularly like about episode 13, even though it's just another random thing to happen in an already confusing story and just an entirely result of Anthony Amy's contract, I like the way that the Master turns up and just throws a curveball.
Oh, he just lifts.
What's going on? He does. You've had, particularly after 12 weeks of basically back and forth of the Doctor and the Valyard and the Inquisitor, suddenly you've got the Master on the screen having a whale of a time, getting to be, rather than just the villain who's about to get beaten, actually getting to be there on high above them all. And you said as we were watching it, like the first Doctor almost in the Three Doctors, talking down at them, he's the one who knows what's going on, he's got the upper hand, he's got that high status of saying, look at me, I'm clever, I've been sitting in the Matrix, goodness knows how. I've been sitting in the Matrix, I know what actually went on. And it now, for my own amusement, I will turn up and lord it over all of you and tell you why I'm the better Time Lord. And that I do enjoy, and it's a different dynamic for those trial scenes once he's there.
Yeah.
I think, however, one of the problems made with the story, and it's a problem that's always going to feature in these kind of Time Lord heavy stories, is when you think of the new series and the importance of characters like Rose giving it a grounding.
Yeah.
I just said there about the trial scenes, I said the words the Doctor, the Valyard, the Inquisitor, and the Master, three characters whose names on the something. Yeah. Up until the point where Glitz and Mel turn up in episode 13, no one in episode 13 has an actual name.
Yeah, and to be fair, Mel doesn't seem to have an actual character. I mean, Bonnie Langford, I think, gets a bad press, but she's actually she's fine. And I quite like her, but Mel practically admits she doesn't have a character. I don't think there's ever been a companion who's introduced so shoddily since Dodo, I mean.
And you're right, she declares in that episode that she's as boring as they come.
I mean, the bit I love is, it shows Mel's character when she takes her cardigan off in resolution to go into the Matrix. That's Mel. She takes her cardigan off.
Which is also quite impressive. She clearly understands the imaginary nature of the Matrix, since as she's looking at it on the screen, it appears to be outside. So if anything, she'd be putting her cardigan on to go into the Matrix.
Exactly, silly girl.
Glitz is a much more, I would say, rounded. He's certainly a much more fun character and makes the whole thing much more watchable. I mean, obviously Mr. Popplewick is the other character with a name, but he's not a real person either. So you've not really got, I mean, obviously you care about what happens to the Doctor, but there's no kind of real down-to-earth people apart from Glitz and Mel. And yeah, Glitz is fun. And another thing you said we were watching is that his character is quite different from in the first four episodes. He's much softer.
Yeah.
And of course, as is established in the story, in episode 13 and 14, we don't know. Maybe he was soft all along, and the tampering with the Matrix has hardened him up. There's not really much reason for them to do that. I think it's more... And we don't know how much time has passed either. But yes, in order to make him a more likeable character, his character is quite
different. You can kind of see from this episode why Mel eventually ends up running off with him, can't you? Because he's a bit of a lovable old rogue rather than the slightly cold-blooded mercenary.
And I think you can always think she's so someone you wouldn't associate with that kind of character that almost... what she gets out of it is hanging around with someone who isn't like her.
And she likes a bit rough.
That's the other way of putting it, I suppose. Some things I did find slightly odd. Let's not go down all of them. The Master defines himself in relation to the Valyard and not wanting someone else who's evil around. And obviously, fans might talk about the Master being an evil villain, but I've never before thought of the Master defining himself as evil. I think he might understand that he's a villain and is a bit selfish and is going around, you know, he's killing people for his own ends, but that he would particularly buy into the concept of evil and be a proud purveyor of evil is a kind of mark of
poor writing, isn't it? When evil characters declare that they are evil and they enjoy being evil, it's a bit weak. And I think you've touched on something that I do find problematic about the Valyard, which is that for all that they make out that he's the Doctor as he might have been, or he's some kind of summation of evil, he's basically like the Master. He's got a rubbish scheme like the Master. He ends up disguised as the Keeper of the Matrix, which is a very kind of end of the sea devils. It's a very masterish thing to do, to disguise yourself as someone else and run away. The disappointing thing about the Valeyard for me is that it squanders the fantastic opportunity to do something mythic and to examine what happens when you are the last Doctor, when you're contemplating your own future.
The kind of thing that Last of the Time Lords does with the Master.
Yeah, and it just has the Valeyard as just a kind of slightly rubbish version of the Master rather than the Doctor, but with a slightly different morality.
Mm.
And you made a really interesting point. The line, the catharsis of spurious morality, there's nothing you can do to prevent the catharsis of spurious morality.
It's the widely derided line.
You get the sense, actually, that Pip and Jane maybe think catharsis means triumph. But other than that, I think you're right in saying that the catharsis of spurious morality suggests that the Valeyard's trying to purge Time Lord society of the spurious morality that's infected it. And actually, he's doing something almost doctorish. There's almost something vaguely heroic that could have been explored there, but it's so thrown away.
I think he's saying, this is my reading of that bizarre line, is that he's defining all of those judges at the trial, the people who oddly the Doctor calls the Court of Appeal judges. Why the Court of Appeal is doing an initial judgment, but let's not go into the flawed legal system.
The trial doesn't make any sense anyway.
No, but he's saying he doesn't agree with that morality, and therefore it is a spurious morality, and he's going to be cathartic by clearing it out. I mean, it's a ridiculous thing. I guess it's possibly trying to mimic the wordiness of the Sixth Doctor, but it's all very odd. I mean, it's no more odd than a megabyte modem, whatever that is supposed to be.
I mean, that final episode, I talked earlier on about episode 13 being a kind of synthesis of Robert Holmes. Episode 14's almost a synthesis of Pip and Jane, with lots of things that kind of do work right up against things that you just hang your head. The megabyte modem, the whole climax of that story, you just hang your head.
It is perhaps a sign of the series not having a script editor on that episode to go, what on earth does that mean?
Absolutely.
And I think also, I mean, and I guess this is possibly, I might be being slightly unfair to the series as it was being made at the time, because obviously Eric Saward had left as well. And this also may be to do with how television was made then, fair enough. But I can't fathom that you sit down to produce, and I don't mean as the producer, I mean produce in the broadest sense, a series of Doctor Who, or any series, which has an overarching story running through, and that the approach seems to be to just commission a bunch of people to write those stories with the loosest sense of tying in, and not have sat down and gone, this is how it starts, and this is how it ends, and this is the point of it. You know, so if a writer falls through, it's fine, because you've got your overarching story and you know how it ends and someone else can write it. To be at a point where you genuinely don't know or can't use how the story is supposed to end is just a ridiculous situation to be in.
It's not the first time that's happened, though, because The Key to Time had almost exactly the same problem. They got to the end and Douglas Adams had to himself cobble together that ending where the Doctor decides to disassemble the key to time, because they hadn't actually worked out what he was going to do when he'd got all the six parts of the key to time.
It's amazing, isn't it? These people who are you know, working on a TV show and very, very good in so many ways, it seems a really obvious thing that if you're going to do a story arc, you
start
should
with
know
the
how
end
it ends.
Mind, yeah.
Absolutely. It's like... And fair enough, I know things like 24 had that kind of problem, was when they've been extended unexpectedly or whatever, but you can't imagine The Killing starting production without them actually knowing who did it.
Mm.
I mean, actually, maybe there are shows like that, or something like Murder One. If you're going to do a high-concept serial, there's one thing you have to get right, and that's the end. And, you know, whatever personnel problems are happening, you'd think someone would have written down at the beginning, here's how it starts, this is the point of it, and here's the end. Because if you're going to get the end wrong, you might as well not bother.
Yeah.
Well, I think we can take it that we were not particularly impressed, much as we enjoyed elements of the last two episodes.
I particularly loved how the High Council, or sorry, the Court, escape the Valyard's deadly mazer weapon by basically ducking down under the tables.
I think it's slightly unfair. I think it was amusing, but also the doctor has somehow fiddled with it, and he has reduced the special mazer to a quite bad video effect. So he has managed to deal with it partly already. But we weren't very impressed, and I think that's reflective of our general view of season 23 as a whole.
Yeah.
So fingers crossed, because we are trying to celebrate Doctor Who, but obviously it has its ups and its downs, and we love it for all its idiosyncrasies. That the randomizer today will choose us a season that we can really get our teeth into discussing because we love so much of it, and that we can actually really enjoy some quality maybe with the next serial.
Well, for me, I think the good news is that there's probably only two or three series in the whole of the run that I don't particularly enjoy, and we've covered two of them.
Yeah.
So
it can only improve from here. Okay, the randomizer is word up and ready to go. Are you ready, Matt?
I'm ready.
Okay. Randomizer, please tell us which season of Doctor Who we should watch a serial from next. Twenty-five!
Oh, okay.
So we're not actually going that much further, and we move into the Sylvester McCoy era for our third one. Well, season 25 is, with not that I want to give out any spoilers, one of my favourite seasons of Doctor Who ever. So that's a good start. We have, off the top of my head, in broadcast order, a choice between Remembrance of the Daleks, The Happiness Patrol, Silver Nemesis, and The Greatest Show in the Galaxy. So, Matt, which of those four, and why, do you think we should go for?
Well, I was just thinking, it's amazing, isn't it, that actually 25 years have passed since all of those stories were on TV. It's exactly...
It is the halfway.
Halfway, point. Yeah. So, which is a bit poignant, actually, because I can remember watching all of those on TV on their first run, so...
I can't, because I didn't really watch Doctor Who, or if I did, I can't remember. I know that I definitely saw some of them. I saw some of Remembrance, and I saw some of Silver Nemesis. I've got my memories of the two are very mixed up in my head, and I'm pretty sure I saw some of Greatest Show. But we were... I don't think we made a specific date with it, and I'm not sure if I saw whole serials, and I've got no proper memories of the time, sadly, of sitting down enjoying it. Is there one that immediately occurs to you? I mean, actually, I remember you saying in the first episode that you'd watched season 25 quite recently.
I've watched series 25 very recently.
But you did watch all of it, so the fact that you've watched it isn't going to particularly lean towards one story or another.
So, I think Silver Nemesis is a hugely underrated story. I think it's incredibly lightweight. However, it's an anniversary story, and I think if you edited it into a 75-minute TV movie and you stuck it on as part of Children in Need, that actually is as entertaining as The Five Doctors and no worse in any way.
I mean, you say that, although one of the things that I think makes Silver Nemesis better is the extended edition, so actually editing it down is perhaps the wrong direction to go.
Disgracefully, of course, the special edition isn't available on DVD, so...
I'm aware that's one of the things that makes you angriest in the world.
It is possibly worse than almost anything that's happened in the last 100 years in the world.
I don't think that's saying too much. Yeah, we definitely would like a DVD release for the Silver Nemesis Special Edition. And if there are rights issues, sort them out. I think there aren't rights issues. Let's not even dwell on
it. I can't see that there could be rights issues, because it's just bits of Doctor Who. All of the extended bits on the DVD as cut scenes.
Well, me thinking aloud, I love Remembrance of the Daleks. I love The Happiness Patrol. I watched the first episode of The Happiness Patrol the other day, but I haven't watched any more of it, so I'm quite happy to go back to the beginning. I like Silver Nemesis a lot. it's a lot of fun, and I can overlook some of its problems because it is fun. And Greatest Show I haven't seen, actually, for a very long time.
I remember kind of liking it, and I loved the novelisation, which is, to be honest, true of nearly every novelisation I ever read when I was younger. And it's one of those stories I remember the novelisation more than the broadcast, more than the TV version.
Mm-hmm.
So Greatest Show would be good for me, because I haven't seen it in ages. The Happiness Patrol or Remembrance would be good, because both of them are up there in my favourite stories. And Silver Nemesis would be good, because it's a jolly old laugh. I lean slightly towards Greatest Show, because I haven't seen it for so long. But I could really go with any of it. I haven't seen Remembrance for a while.
Greatest Show is an interesting one, because I think it's amazing for three quarters of its length, and I really don't understand the final episode. So I'm not averse to giving Greatest Show another chance. I'm still sold on Silver Nemesis, I think, as well. In this anniversary year, it kind of behoves us to watch the anniversary story.
Well, it's the anniversary story in a sense, but I think that it's an anniversary season. I mean, certainly Remembrance...
It's the 23rd of November episode.
But you say that, but I mean, Remembrance feels as much of an anniversary story. It's set in Totter's Lane, it's set in 1963. It's very much going back to the first episode. It's almost more... The two of them together are an anniversary pair. It takes the Daleks, whereas Silver Nemesis takes the Cybermen. But I mean, either of them could have been...
Yeah. Remembrance of the Daleks is possibly... It's certainly the best Doctor Who story since 1984, and it is possibly the best of the entire 1980s, so...
Well, it's certainly the best since 1980s. It's the best since the Decay of Androzani, isn't it? It's without question. But it's a hard decision, because I would love to see it watch Remembrance. I've seen it, so I know it backwards. And I'd love to watch The Happiness Patrol again, because I think that of all its flaws, it's got a lot going for
it. It's got the Candyman. One of my favourite monsters ever.
My only reticence about Silver Nemesis is almost that I actually want to watch the extended edition, and that's not what we're doing. We'd have to watch the broadcast version, which just isn't... I don't enjoy quite as much. But it's still fun. Is it Remembrance and Greatest Show that are four episodes?
Yeah, Remembrance and Greatest Show are the longer ones. It's an embarrassment of riches this season, I think, isn't it? It's so hard to choose, because actually I'd quite happily watch all of them.
I'd happily sit down and watch all of season 25 and just, you know, if I had to do have a desert island season, it would be a toss-up between season 25 and season 26. Let's watch Silver Nemesis, because it is the anniversary story, and all things will be mine.
They surely will, honey. They surely will.
We didn't even set that up. That was really good, wasn't it? And by really good, I mean as good as Silver Nemesis. So that's what the randomizer has selected us. It's chosen season 25, another one from the 80s. But hopefully, whereas Troll of a Time Lord was apparently acceptable in the 80s, Silver Nemesis will prove marginally better. So tune in next time, find out how we enjoyed Silver Nemesis and which season we'll be doing next. Bye-bye.
Bye.